This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Bart, Butthead, and the Boys of South Park. Flaming Email, Road Rage, Jerry Springer, Dr. Laura, Linda Tripp. Are we seeing a decline in civility?
Excuse me!
Steve Martin entertaining us with a barbed demand for some respect 20 years ago.
I'm sorry, but I am angry! I come out here, and I can't get a little cooperation from the backstage crew. Excuse me! I'm sorry, I'm pissed!
I'm sorry.
In this portion of the Afternoon Magazine, etiquette. Our guest this afternoon is Mark Caldwell, and I think we're in for a thought-provoking look at manners and morals. For example, Caldwell defends rudeness in certain situations. He says, an insult can be just the right note, a needed stink bomb. Politeness, he says, can hide cruelty and contempt. Mark Caldwell is the author of A Short History of Rudeness, Manners, Morals, and Misbehavior in Modern America. Listeners, you're welcome to join us with your questions and comments. Here are the telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, use the toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL. Mark Caldwell is a literary critic and the author of A Socio-Medical History of Tuberculosis in America, The Last Crusade. He teaches at Fordham University. His new book is A Short History of Rudeness, Manners, Morals, and Misbehavior in Modern America. Again, our telephone numbers, toll-free, 1-800-222-WILL in Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL. Mark Caldwell, good afternoon. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Is it possible to gauge our civility or incivility today?
Well, I think in a sense it is impossible to gauge it. If what you mean by gauging it is, could we ever do any kind of survey and sort of add up the what must be several hundred billion acts we all perform every day and kind of decide which were rude and which were polite and decide which added up to the greater total? I don't think we can do it. I think part of the problem with this as a subject is that we're really caught in a world of perceptions, and I think if you've just been riled by somebody's act, you think that manners are going to hell and rudeness is the order of the day. I think that's the key to this situation more often than not.
It's just whatever happened to us 15 minutes ago. That's what we remember.
Well, I think so, and I think it's a sort of paradoxical situation because I think almost everyone will have some experience that chimes in with this, where somebody does something that simply rubs you the wrong way. You tend to react to it often with an anger and a rage that's entirely out of proportion to the seriousness of the situation. And it makes you think, well, what's the world coming to? And yet at the same time, it's very interesting to me that we tend to react in that kind of excessive way to what seem to be very small dust-ups. And it suggests that manners are really important to us, which is a reason to be optimistic. We certainly get exercised about them, and they can't be in all that much danger if they're so important to us.
Yeah. Maybe you would share with us the tale that you share with readers in the book, a tale the sociobiologist E.O. Wilson likes to tell about porcupines.
Yes, this is a porcupine story, and it's a tale with, I think, an important lesson behind it. Wilson's making the argument that most of our social behavior and our social behavior with each other is hardwired, that it's a biological thing. And as a kind of entertaining illustration of that, he talks, it's a German fable, I think, about porcupines who are freezing in the winter, and if they get too close together, they're warm, but they're poking each other with their quills. If they get too far apart from each other, well, they're not getting poked, but they're freezing to death. And so over time, they have to work out a system where they're close enough to share some body heat, but far enough from each other not to be bleeding to death, and they call that system good manners. And I think there's a huge undercurrent of truth in that.
Mm-hmm. Civility necessary for our survival.
Well, I think it is. I mean, I think that's the important thing about it. It's why it's really not a trivial subject to be talking about. It's absolutely necessary for our survival. And it's not very hard to find in newspapers and magazines incidents where a failure of manners escalated and led to violence and injury. I mean, I think road rage is the topic that's on everybody's mind in this connection at present, but there are all sorts of other instances of the same kind of thing.
Yeah. What led you to investigate manners and morals in America in the 20th century?
Well, I've always been interested in, I'm a literary critic by training, and I've been interested in important human systems that are resistant to being studied by scientists and sociologists, that just don't lend themselves to quantitative investigation. And what struck me about this subject was that, in the last 10 years, I noticed, and I'm certainly not alone in this, that there seems to have been a huge upsurge of concern about and interest in manners. And yet every time I looked at it, I thought, well, but how do we get a grasp on manners? What are they anyway? How can we investigate them in any kind of systematic way, because they're everywhere. They're ubiquitous. I mean, you start practicing them the moment you wake up in the morning, and you keep on doing it until you go to sleep at night. And you know, I've even found myself having manners crises in dreams. So I think you even think about it when you're asleep in some way.
Yeah. Well, you know, with a project like this, I'm really curious how you began to organize your thoughts and begin working on this project and researching it, because it is so all-encompassing.
Well, it is, and I decided that the only way that I could make any sense out of it, given whatever analytical tools I come to the subject, was to think of it as a system and to try and define these terms. What's rude? What's polite? What's important and good about being polite, but maybe also what's bad about being polite, and to ask the same questions about being rude. And when I started to talk to colleagues and friends about the subject, the thing that instantly struck me was the most interesting kind of situation was the one where two people come into collision socially, and one person's trying to be polite, painfully trying to be polite, and inadvertently does something that offends and even injures the other person. And I thought, there's something interesting about a subject like manners that is so volatile, that can turn on a dime like that. And what I decided I wanted mainly to investigate in the book was how that happened, what there was about good manners that lent themselves to that kind of thing.
Yeah. This is very thought-provoking, very interesting. You write, manners are so consistently confusing that one comes to suspect this is essential to their proper functioning.
Well, I do think that, and I think that's thank you for picking it up. That's an important arguing point to my mind in the book. And I think, well, let me give a concrete example. Mm-hmm. I think this is a good way to do it. The thing that offends me most personally, and this is entirely and purely a personal thing, is if I walk into the doctor's office or the dentist's office and people start calling me by my first name. That instantly sends my mercury right through the top of the thermometer, because I think I'm being infantilized. I think I'm being disrespected. It's as if it's the doctor is the wise adult and I'm the dependent child, and it pulls all the wrong wires with me. And yet, after having this happen again and again, being quite rude and yelling at these people, don't call me Mark, call me Mister, it occurred to me that I was just, in most cases, misreading the situation. They were trying to put me at my ease. They were trying to make the situation less formal and intimidating than it was. And I thought, well, on the one hand, there's sort of no way, if I were setting myself up as a manners expert, there's no way that I would be able to give anybody practical advice about how to handle that situation. But I thought, in a sense, in the very pattern of misunderstanding, it forces us to think about what other people are thinking in ways that we're not prepared for. And that's a good thing for us to be doing. It's just a kind of exercise of our social skills that if we were always just following a book of 10 rules, we'd never be able to perform.
Yeah. The pace of our lives, I think, has got to play a role in how we react and interact with others. For example, when you go into the doctor's office and they call you Mark, and you know that sets you off. We're in a position, I think, these days where we're called on immediately to size things up. and to you know, read everything that's going on in the situation immediately.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. To me, the thing, the life situation that illustrates that better than almost anything else is when I come into my office in the morning. As recently as 5 or 6 years ago, I just went to my mailbox, got the mail, read it, and then started my day. But now I go to the mailbox, get the mail, read it, pick up the phone, get my voicemail, listen to that. Then I have to turn on the computer, deal with my email, and I have two email accounts, so there are two email accounts to deal with. And I've noticed over time that the sheer number of messages I have to respond to from coming from different angles makes me much more sort of nervous and on edge than I was before when I started the workday. And I think insofar as there's something about road rage, that's one of the reasons why we're so worried about it. If you look at recent statistics about the increasing number of road trips that people are taking, even in cities where the population isn't increasing, there's been a huge increase in the number of trips we take in cars. Cars are, they move fast and they're potentially dangerous, and so instead of maybe one scary or offending incident in a week, now we're experiencing one every couple of days, and I think that really does put manners more at risk, and it's just statistical, it raises the risk of your having an encounter with somebody that's going to be unpleasant.
Yeah, and, you know, if only we could hit that delete key faster, and go on. In the book, you talk about mobility. Americans are very much interested in mobility and moving out, moving up. You say movement mangles manners. How?
Well, I think in several ways. I think there's a whole list of ways it mangles manners. First of all, there's the travel phenomenon. I mean, in addition to road rage, another sort of hot topic of the last year or so has been air rage. And when you're traveling, of course, all of your routes are at least temporarily cut off. It makes people nervous to travel. If you're in a plane, you're cooped up with maybe hundreds of other people in a very artificial situation where the air smells funny and the food isn't very good. And it seems to me simply the dislocation of that kind of situation. You have no idea who you're sitting next to on the plane. All of those things, I think, raise the ante and make it easier for there to be ructions. That's one way that mobility mangles manners. But I think there's two deeper and maybe more endemic ways that it does that. One is we live in a country where people move a lot, and that in the early decades of the 19th century, American demographers noticed that Americans tended to move around a lot, and they speculated that this wouldn't last. As soon as the whole country was settled from coast to coast, people would take roots in their towns and stay there for most of their lives. Well, that hasn't been borne out. We've become, apparently, more and more mobile with every census, and it shows no signs of slackening. And what that means is that if you look around your neighborhood, fewer and fewer of the people that you run into on the street have been there for any length of time, so you don't know who they are. They come from other regions, other countries, where people may have very different customs and very different ways of interacting. I'm completely taken aback, for example, when I go to the south, to a city like Memphis, and walk down the street and have people simply say hello to you on the street. To a New Yorker, that's downright frightening, not just rude. And yet we're moving around and coming in contact with each other in all sorts of ways. And I think that is a problem for manners. And then the third one, not to go on at too great length, I think is that mobility doesn't only just mean for Americans moving from place to place, but it means moving from class to class. Most of us want to better ourselves during our careers, and we certainly want our children to do better than we're doing. And to some degree, it seems possible for Americans to do that. But manners have traditionally also, as if they weren't a complicated enough subject, they've also been connected to class. And the whole question is, what class do I belong to? What manners are right for the class I belong to? What class am I trying to get into? And are the manners different there? And how can I avoid making mistakes if I'm trying to move my way up into another social group? So all of those are mobility issues, and I think they all make manners complicated.
It's like we've got to rethink how long, going back to the idea of the porcupines, How long are my quills? How long are your quills?
Right, and it's easier to do if you've been sitting around the same porcupine for a while. You know, after a few stabs, you have a visceral sense of just how long that porcupine's quills are.
Yeah. We have a couple of callers waiting to talk with us. Our guest this afternoon, Mark Caldwell. He is the author of A Short History of Rudeness, Manners, Morals, and Misbehavior in Modern America. This is The Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Our first caller this afternoon on line 4 in Mattoon. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Just a couple of points. One, I've noticed, the thing that I've noticed that tends to make me think that we're not quite as polite, maybe a little less civil as a society now, is the disappearance of the words please and thank you and a lack of graciousness. And I think that's one indicator, and I don't know where that comes from, but I think that's one part. And touching on what you mentioned about the doctor's office, I agree that I don't think that it's intentional to anything other than a casualization of the relationship. But I also agree with your assessment that it tends to put the doctor on a different plane. And the way that I've handled that is when I get into the situation where I'm referred to by my first name, I refer to the doctor by his or her first name. And that way I kind of try to level the emotional playing field, because I refuse to deify that individual just because of their title.
I think that's an ingenious and way to deal with it, and I wish I had your presence of mind. I just usually blow up and say, "Stop calling me by my first name." But it's an interesting question. If the caller is still on the line, mm-hmm. If I can pin you down a little bit, where is it that you most have the feeling that please and thank you, to take that example, has dropped out? Let me explain why I'm asking that question.
Sure.
There was that very amusing Steve Martin bit that opened the program, where mm-hmm. excuse me is turned from an apology into an attack. Mm-hmm. And I've noticed in going into stores, for example, welcome to whatever store, being greeted by, I find much more politeness in certain situations in life than I used to find it. And yet it seems either completely meaningless or just a commercial gesture. So it's almost as if I'm hearing please and thank you much more in the discount store than I used to, and yet I'm getting less pleasure out of it.
I run into it mostly in service situations where there's an exchange of services. You know, whether you're taking an order, I mean, I always try when I'm in a restaurant to say please when I request something and say thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And I spent 20 years in a restaurant business, and most of that was through exchanges over the counter, where I spent a lot of time as a customer and I spent a lot of time as a manager dealing with customers. And I just noticed that over the 20 years that from a customer basis there was a lot less please and thank you and a lot more of this is expected, I don't have to be considerate.
It's a thing that I've noticed, and as far as you can survey this in any kind of systematic way, I think you're always on good ground if you point to a particular place and say there's been a deterioration in manners over the last 10 or 20 years. But a thing that I've found is that I can almost always, if I scratch my head and think hard about examples, think of a place where they've gotten much better than they were 20 years ago. The classic example from New York is Times Square. Mm-hmm. As recently as 5 or 6 years ago, Times Square was absolutely frightening to walk through. People were so antisocial and uncivil. But now when I walk through it, it's eerie. It's as if I've had people say excuse me in Times Square, and it's hard to do that because there are such mobs of people that you can't even hear the people who are bumping into you on the sidewalk. And I thought it's strange that in that place that was famous as a kind of raucous and rude sort of place, manners have really improved in the last 4 or 5 years, and yet I'm perfectly willing to believe that, say, in a restaurant, I mean, I wonder why it would be that in a restaurant situation there might have been some kind of deterioration.
I think it's because at one time restaurants were viewed as a luxury, and it was something special to go out to eat. And now it's just become a matter of convenience. And fast food restaurants, quick service restaurants have taken away a lot of that social exchange that you get from being at a table and having someone come up to wait on you. And it's gone from a service to just being an order taker. But one place I have noticed that I think the pendulum is swinging back and this is an interesting little thing, and maybe it's just in my geographic area, is holding doors for people. Years ago, it used to be common for people to hold the door for someone coming behind or someone with packages. It was just a matter of being polite. It was the way I was taught. And then it seemed like people just quit doing it. And I've noticed over the last 3 years or so that more and more people seem to be holding doors for other people and even delaying their own progress in order to hold the door for someone. So I think that makes your point, you know, that in some areas, yeah, it is swinging back to a more mannered area.
Well, I've noticed that. I even saw in somebody's etiquette column a question about what are you supposed to do if somebody holds the door for you twice if you're in one of those vestibules where there is a string of doors. Are you supposed to thank the person for holding the door both times, only the first time or only after the second time? Well, I don't know the answer to that. But I think part of that, I mean, I've noticed that as a phenomenon too. I think there's a gender component in that because I think beginning in the 1960s and 1970s, women started rightly claiming an equal place in the social sphere. And if you were male and you were sensitive to that, if you got to the point of holding a door for a woman, because it was traditionally in the past something males did for females, and you suddenly thought, wait a minute, if I hold the door for this woman behind me, am I, in a sense, putting her in a subordinate sort of place? And it became a sort of dilemma for me. I thought, well, I should hold the door, but on the other hand, I don't want to seem to be putting this woman in the place of some kind of social inferior. And I was confused about whether to do it. I did it, but on a couple of occasions, I had women glower at me as if implying...
Good for everyone. That is so sane. Let's talk with another caller. Our next caller is on a mobile phone. Good afternoon. Hello? Caller's not there. Okay, let's go on to another caller on line one, a caller in Taylorville. Good afternoon.
Yes, hello. I'd like to point out that with a lot of this impoliteness, there's a kind of a background radiation of gleeful spite. I had a friend... he was a friend, called me his spiritual father, he did. I introduced him to the likes of artists like Oscar Kokoschka and Egon Schiele and numerous other expressionists. I introduced him, it's possible that he would have found a lot of these things himself, Domenico Scarlatti, the harpsichord sonatas, et cetera, or Robert M. Lindner, author of Rebel Without a Cause and 60 Minute Hour, et cetera, et cetera. And he was just amazed at some of these things I helped him discover. And I was overjoyed that I was, I did feel a little like his spiritual father. Years, not that many years later, with a snort of something like a contentiousness, patronizing contentiousness, he dismissed all that. And I remember I showed him one of the papers I wrote in graduate school, and he said a friend of his said I had a hang-up with my mother. It was a critique of pop art. And I read him, periodically. I did things like... I would discourse on other things. I read him a poem not too many months ago. The writer, a great Russian poet, Osip Mandelstam, and he said a friend of his said he's nothing. Yeah, it's always somebody else by way of him who says that this or that thing I've done is nothing. There is a kind of natural element, I think, in the human soul. I'd like to read you just a fragment of that poem. It'll take about half a minute. Not half a minute. I can read it because it's in my head. I was trying to find a book. Mandelstam, who died in one of Stalin's concentration camps, he was somewhat crazy. But he compares our time in history to a beautiful wounded animal. In any age, plays with an invisible spine. But your age, my beautiful, pitiful beast, your spine, excuse me, my beautiful, pitiful beast, has been broken
and you look back
cruel and weak.
Like a beast that was once supple.
At the tracks of your own paws.
Now, believe me, that's one of the great Russian poems of the 20th century, and he dismissed it like it was a bug fart, if you'll pardon the expression.
Well, let's bring the guest in here and into the conversation, and I think that this caller sort of points out how we all want to be treated civilly and with respect, and we don't want to be dismissed.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this brings up what I think you can't talk about this subject without bringing up, which is the moral dimension of manners, mm-hmm. because in a sense, obviously, all of us want our dignity as human beings to be respected, and any act that intentionally and for no good reason assaults somebody's human dignity is a rude act. I don't have any hesitation in branding it as that, and I go further, I think it's an immoral act. And so I couldn't agree more with the caller that the behavior that he's describing is rude. On the other hand, and I don't think this is an issue in the situations he was talking about, sometimes, because you began the broadcast by mentioning that in some contexts I defend rudeness, mm-hmm. and I do, I think rudeness sometimes is meant to wound and it's directed at individuals, and it's almost impossible to imagine a situation where that's a good thing. And where it, apart from hurting individuals, isn't bad for our sense of collective well-being. On the other hand, manners are also things, and to me I think this is the thing that's a keynote of manners, they're customs that bind groups of people together. Well, we need to bind together as groups of people. And yet sometimes people are bound together in groups by things that aren't so good. I mean, they're binding together just to benefit economically, to exclude other people from some kind of privileged status. And when that happens, sometimes you need the act of assault, the act of rudeness, the act that suddenly reminds everybody that, wait, what's holding this group together is not a very good thing. The classic story that illustrates that is the Emperor's New Clothes, the situation being that the adults are bamboozled by a couple of con men, and it takes the child's rude pointing out of the fact to restore everybody to a sense of the way things are.
Mm. Let's talk with another caller on line 3 in Bloomington. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Hello.
Good afternoon. I, too, am annoyed by this first name stuff. I'm 85 years old, and I feel that if I don't deserve to be called Mr. at this age, when will I ever? And that brings me to something else. How much politeness do we owe telemarketers, particularly those who begin with a first name? How are you, so-and-so?
Oh, if you're asking, you've just pushed, if possible, a button that sends my mercury even higher than the doctor calling me by my first name. I can tell you what I've done. I'm not particularly proud of any of these things, but I've done all of them at one time or another. The first thing I've done, and I think this is probably rude, is I've hung up, and not hung up gently, but hung up with as much force as I thought the receiver could stand without having to be replaced. Another thing that I've done, and I think this is probably pretty rude too, is I've sort of preempted the caller and said, well, what's your first name? What's your last name? Where are you calling from? So, and, you know, eventually they hang up because this is it's not profitable to talk to somebody like this. And yet, on the other hand, I'm not entirely proud of having done these things because I've found out who gets jobs as a telemarketer, how terribly full of pressure that job is, how little those people are paid, and what I'm telling you is I have absolutely no idea what to do. What do you do, if I may ask?
I usually tell them I'm not interested in hang up. That's about what I do.
I think that's the sanest and politest thing.
You know, you can also tell them, please put me on your no-call list, and then for a certain number of months or years, they're not supposed to call you back.
Well, but there are so many of them.
I know.
And, of course, they have a genius for calling at exactly the time when you're about to sit down to dinner or something like that, so that it's a kind of, it's not just that it's an intrusion, but it's an intrusion on your private life. And I think that is another very strong and problematic part of politeness and rudeness. Manners are a public thing, and yet on the other hand, in part, they're designed to allow us to protect our private space. And so I think one of the things about telemarketers is it's as much when they call as what they do when they call.
Yeah.
Well, thanks very much.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Judith Martin, Miss Manners, I think came up with a beautiful piece of advice on this subject, and that's get an answering machine. And she says, you know, the answering machine is now our butler. And if you're not willing to leave your card with the butler, in other words, if you're not willing to leave a message, well, I'm under no obligation to talk with you or call you back, right?
Well, yes, I agree with that, although the telemarketers have gotten around that, too. And this is recent. It's within the last year or two come home to find very long sales pitches on my answering machine.
Really?
Now, of course, and recorded ones. You can skip them, of course,
yeah.
But they still find a way to get to you. But yes, I think that's a solution.
Yeah. Well, in our house also, we have found that there are so many calls that not only do we have an answering machine, but we turn down the ringer and we turn down the volume control on the recording device so that we don't hear ourselves answering the phone, and we don't hear, we don't hear anything because it is such an intrusion.
Well, it's funny, but it's that's not really new with the era of telemarketers. It's very strange when you stand back and look at it that it's surely true that the telephone was the first device ever invented that simply, when it rang, and this is true from the time it rang, everybody assumed no matter what you're doing, you have to stop what you're doing, pick it up, and it trumps almost every other activity you may be engaging in. And I think it's another feature of the mobility problem. As soon as we had these communication devices, something in us made us think, well, we can't just ignore them. They're not like a letter waiting on the floor when it's been put through the mail slot. This thing is wrong, and I've got to go answer it right now. And I think that immediately raises the social temperature. There's a very interesting book by Carolyn Marvin called When Old Technologies Were New. And she talks about the period when the telephone was becoming very common in the U.S. and the kind of panic and even fright that generated in people. People, for example, were afraid that their kids would get on the telephone and make arrangements to elope, which the family would be unable to know about, and that it was a threat, really, to the whole social well-being of the family. And I don't know, in some cases that may have happened, but I think the phenomenon of the phone and other kinds of devices like that's interesting.
Yeah. Well, now we have those fears for the Internet and chat rooms and so on. Let's talk with another caller on line one, a caller in Urbana. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
I don't know whether you've mentioned the people who come ringing your doorbell, especially to, quote, share the Bible with you. Seems I'm always on a ladder or deep in some project and I have to extricate myself, come to the front door, only to find a pair of people eager to share their religious beliefs and essentially tell me that mine are not as good as theirs. So I have a standard line, which is when I see this pair of people, I say, I can tell that you're here to sell your religion to me. And they always say, we're not here to sell anything. I say, yes, you are. And I'm deeply insulted that you feel that and that you're just assuming that whatever you have is better than what I have. And then I shut the door. And I told this to an Nepali student who's studying in Hawaii now and sent me an email and said, I don't understand why somebody feels I have to, that it's so important to make sure that I believe the same thing that they do. What do I do about this? He couldn't figure out what the norms were for dealing with people like that. So I shared with him what I do, and he sent me an email back saying, thank you so much for giving me an idea of how to deal with these people. And I've asked them, I've called up their churches and said, would you please take me off your list of places to go and visit? Just don't knock on my door anymore.
Well, that probably got you put even more firmly on.
Well, they came back right then on their schedule again, and I said, I called your church, and they said, well, we didn't know if you'd moved or not. And I would like to, I would love to have a little sign I could put by my doorway that would discourage those people, but I don't know how to... I don't want to offend a guest who might we might end up talking religion. I don't have anything against that, but I just don't feel like being proselytized by somebody who feels that they've got to convert me to whatever it is that they believe in. So I'd be interested in if anybody has any thoughts about how to deal with these folks, and so that I don't have to deal with them.
Well, characteristically, I don't have any practical advice to offer. I share your feeling. I mean, a thing that's a specialty in New York is people will preach on the subway, and I take a subway ride every day that's a five-minute ride without between stops, and you can't get out of the car because the doors are closed, and so you will have to listen to a very loud five-minute sermon on various religious faiths, and my blood boils when that happens because I'm usually trying to read a paper or do some work or something like that, and I think this is a huge assault on my personal space. But what strikes me as interesting about this situation is this is one of those situations where manners becomes a very, very, very delicate subject, because if you put yourself in the position of the person who's doing the preaching or ringing the doorbell to proselytize and convert, that person, rightly or wrongly, thinks they're bringing you the truth, thinks they're saving you from eternal damnation. I mean, what does any of us know? They may be right. I'm not taking any doctrinal position here. And what is the rights and wrongs of a moral situation like that? On the one hand, I think you're right, and I'm right to feel that our personal space has been invaded, that, as you said very accurately, the other person is assuming whatever your values are, they're inferior to mine, so mine trump yours. And yet, on the other hand, if you went to the proselytizer, they would say, I must do this. This is right. This is the truth. The classic figure in history who represents that, I think he may be partly mythical, is Diogenes the Cynic, who is a kind of he lived, if he lived at all, and he probably did, at the same time as Plato did. Plato is the great orthodox philosopher of the day, and there's an anecdote recorded of Diogenes, who used to go around Athens provoking people and challenging all their doctrines, wandering into a lecture that Plato gave in which Plato said, man is a featherless biped, and Diogenes is reported to have gone out, killed a chicken, plucked it, and brought it into the lecture and said, here is Plato's chicken. It was very rude, but Diogenes thought he was bringing a cold breeze of truth into that room. And the rights or wrongs of the situation are very hard for me to figure out, and I can't figure them out. That's really the bottom line. Practically, I'm not sure what to do.
Hmm. Another caller is waiting for us on line 4, a caller on a mobile phone. Good afternoon.
Yes, thank you very much for taking my call. A wonderful program. I have a question that relates to the programs that occur on this radio station, especially. I listen to you quite often and contribute also. But every time an interviewer concludes an interview with a person, they say thank you very much for your time, and the interviewee also says thank you instead of you're welcome. Why is there a proper way to do that, or an improper way to do that, or am I just sensitive to the word thank you and you're welcome?
Well, thank you for the question.
That's a very, very interesting question, because every time I've been on an interview program, that's what's happened. Why does the interviewee say thank you? Well, to be crass about it, the interviewee has written a book which he hopes to sell, and being on a radio program, I think, gives the book and the ideas of the person has some currency. So I think it's not an unreasonable thing to do.
Yeah. You know, to this discussion of thank you and you're welcome, I would like to ask you, Mark Caldwell, about your opinion of the words no problem.
Well, there's a whole range of expressions that have come into currency, I'd say maybe in the last 10 or 15 years. I think of these as Generation X expressions. No problem is one of them. Whatever is another one. And what they seem to me to do is be absolutely neutral words, in a sense. It's almost as if you bump into somebody and say, I'm sorry, and they say, no problem. It's weaker than saying, oh, that's all right, I wasn't hurt at all, and yet it's, you know, much stronger than saying, why don't you watch where you're going, or something like that. And it's I think it's a kind of, I'm babbling a little bit about this, but I think that we've had a tendency to invent words for manners situations that are completely neutral, that are neither too apologetic nor aggressive in a certain sort of way. Another, to me, very interesting phenomenon is that in the United States, almost invariably, we tend to say, excuse me, or we inadvertently do something, whereas in England, they say, sorry. And that's, they're totally interchangeable in some way. They're meaningless. And yet, on the other hand, there's a meaning in them. Sorry is an apology, and excuse me is an order, no matter how polite it is to say that. No problem or whatever is completely noncommittal.
Hmm. But yet, at the same time, you know, to say no problem suggests that actually there has been a problem.
Well, that's what I mean. In other words, it suggests that there's been a problem, and yet it also suggests, well, there's been a problem, but I'm not going to make an issue of it. Whatever seems to me to do exactly the same thing. It's kind of as if the lines between hostility and apology have been blurred a little bit. And I don't know whether that's good or bad. It may be a very good thing if there's a... Manners tend to work, I think, kind of well if there's something very neutral you can do, something that's almost empty of anybody's ability to read either hostility or apology into it, but that just diffuses the situation a little.
Yeah.
And in that sense, I think maybe no problem is a good invention.
Let's talk with another caller on line one in Urbana. Hello.
Hello. This is a perfectly delightful conversation. I can't resist asking, do you really think there's hope that the history of rudeness will be short?
Oh, I think the history of rudeness will be as long as the history of mankind.
Oh, I was thinking.
No, the title was an intentional oxymoron.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Thanks for your call this afternoon. We're here near the end of the time that we can spend together today, and I wanted to talk just a little bit about Colonel Mann. He had a paper by the name of Town Topics, and he was a fellow that you refer to in Chapter 1, the first sentence, "The rudest man of the 20th century was a master of every social grace." And his Town Topics was vicious, but I imagine it had a healthy circulation.
Oh, yes.
So how is it that we find ourselves so entertained by bad manners and stories where the sanctimonious are hoist?
Well, Town Topics was a scandal sheet, and it's very interesting because I think we often have the perception in the late 20th century that the media have gone wild with things like the Jerry Springer Show. And yet in Town Topics, you would find reporting about people's private behavior that you would never find in any medium at all in the later part of the 20th century. And it did have a huge circulation. Everybody bought it. Everybody read it, though everybody pretended not to read it. They always pretended to have picked it up on a railroad seat and seen the item when they read it. And yet, Colonel Mann, even though he was reporting on the peccadilloes of the rich and famous, insisted again and again, and he seems really to have believed it, even though he was blackmailing the people he was reporting on at the very same time, that he was serving a moral purpose, that he was showing how people who had set themselves up as the creme de la creme, the class that ought to be imitated, really weren't morally worthy of that kind of admiration. And I think you might say, oh, it's just an example of the way you can sell papers by playing on people's enviousness. But also, I suppose there is a certain kind of moral value in well, I don't know. I don't know if I really think that's true. But it puts moral values front and center. We're thinking about them, even if we're not thinking about them in a way that's ultimately good for us.
Hmm. Well, interesting. Well, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon, Mr. Caldwell.
Well, thank you, and you're welcome.
Mark Caldwell has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. He is the author of A Short History of Rudeness, Manners, Morals, and Misbehavior in Modern America.